This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 139.
So the framing that I've been trying to get leaders to appreciate is that a health plus capability equals productivity. And so I've been thinking about it through the sports analogy, right? Lots of large, very successful professional sports teams have figured this out. It's why they have sports psychologists and top end health folks on staff to try to make sure that their players not only have the skills that they need to be able to perform well on the field, but that they can actually stay on the field, that they have the endurance they need to last the entire game, that they can last for an entire season. And so as corporate athletes, I think we need to start thinking about our workforces in a very similar way. How can we make sure that people not only have the skills to do the job, but that they are in the right headspace to be able to do it and that they're physically capable of being able to move it forward? And to do that, it's not just about whether they have the skills to do it. It's about, do they have the will to be able to do it? And are they in the right mindset to be able to do it? I think as organizations, we need to start thinking about how do we curate both sides of that equation? So I think there's a great opportunity for us to think about it more strategically and make sure our leaders are thinking about it strategically.
How could focusing on health and capabilities drive productivity? What can Ted Lasso, yes, Ted Lasso, teach us about the future of HR? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. There has never been a better time to be in HR, and the expectations on HR leaders has never been higher. If you're really serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR leader, then you need to make attending my Next Gen HR Accelerator program part of your 2025 development plan. And if you're a CHRO who wants your HR team to have even more influence and business impact, then you're going to want to send your team to my Next Gen HR Accelerator as well. Because my Next Gen HR Accelerator is a best-in-class leadership development program specifically designed to equip high-potential HR talent with the skills, mindset, and tools they need to become strategic business leaders and value creators. Over 4 intensive weeks, you will build your business acumen and financial acumen, sharpen your strategic thinking, elevate your executive influence and communication skills, and learn how to translate business strategy to HR initiatives that deliver impact and value. You'll also get targeted feedback and coaching to help you grow as a leader. Every Next Gen HR Accelerator participant receives 360 feedback and coaching from me and leaves with a targeted from to development plan. This is why one participant said the Next Gen HR Accelerator completely transformed their approach to HR, while another said participating in the Next Gen HR Accelerator program was a true game changer. Companies who have trusted me to develop their HR leaders include Verizon, McDonald's, Cardinal Health, Nike, Prudential, Hershey, Kohler, and many more. Our next cohort starts September 9th and registration's now open. Space is limited and we expect to sell out. So to learn more about my Next Gen HR Accelerator program, go to futureofhr.com or reach out directly to me. And with that, my guest this week is Jason LaRue. Jason is a national managing partner for talent and culture at KPMG US, and he essentially serves as the chief operating officer for KPMG's US entire HR function, overseeing 3 critical pillars that touch every aspect of the employee experience for 36,000 employees, including total rewards, workforce shaping, and service delivery. What makes Jason's perspective so valuable is his holistic view of how the human capital systems can drive both business results and employee well-being. Jason also serves on KPMG's Abilities in Motion Business Resource Group Advisory Board, supporting initiatives that create positive change for people with disabilities and their caregivers. This is a great conversation with Jason, and we covered a lot of ground, from chess to Legos to, yes, even Ted Lasso. So I know you're going to learn a lot as we discussed how embracing that initial learning curve, what Jason calls the hockey stick effect, helps leaders succeed in unfamiliar roles, how health and capability drives productivity, and how organizations can make this a competitive advantage, how your talent supply chain creates organizational agility and growth opportunities, how to position wellness initiatives as business drivers rather than nice-to-haves, and why KPMG is centering its talent strategy around skills rather than jobs to enable greater internal mobility, and much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Jason. Jason, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Oh, Jason, it's great to have you on the podcast. Excited to talk to you about your career, KPMG, how you think about talent, health and wellness. We're going to get into a lot of great stuff today. But I want to start off just talking more about your career. You've had an amazing HR career working at companies like Bank of America and almost 20 years now at KPMG. However, I hear you almost decided to sell knives instead of going to HR. So tell us more about your early career and how you really avoid that lucrative career of selling knives.
I graduated from Fairfield University as a political science major the summer between my junior and senior year. Had two career options. One was to go to work for Fleet Bank as a recruiting coordinator, and the other one was to sell Cutco knives. Still convinced I would have been really good at selling Cutco knives, but I made the much less controversial decision, I guess, to go work for Fleet as a recruiting coordinator. And it was a great catalyst for my career. I had a chance to meet somebody who would become a lifelong mentor, Mary McGann. She was amazing, helped me think through basically every major career decision that I made. She saw something in me, gave me lots of interesting opportunities to do different things. And that summer, I really learned what recruiting was all about. So being a recruiting coordinator, you get a chance to experience sort of the end-to-end of how that process works. And I got to take some of the skills that I was good at around access databases in a pre-applicant tracking system era, basically created my own applicant tracking system to help us get through scheduling hundreds of interviews that summer. So it's always fortuitous to see sort of those decisions that you make in the moment. You don't really appreciate how they're going to shape your entire career. But for me, it was a choice between knives and HR, and I chose HR.
I love that story. And you're right. I mean, it's interesting because people have these pivot moments and who knows, maybe you would have gone into sell knives for a while and still came back to HR. I love that you're building like access databases, which people who are listening now who are under a certain age, we will not mention, are like, what the heck is that? But it was really basically early databases that people could build. And we are way past that now. But obviously you had some skill set there. And while your expertise is in talent acquisition, you got this call that really would just change your career because you thought, hey, I'm a talent acquisition expert. This is what I'm really focused on. But you got this call and you were asked to be an HR business partner in a leadership role. What was going through your mind when you got that call? And just tell us more about what that was like.
Yeah. So after graduating from school, I had a chance to spend a year as a search consultant with Management Recruiters International, then went back to work for Fleet. I was an internal technical recruiter and then came to KPMG as a recruiter. And then I spent a couple of years doing that and then moved on to doing executive recruiting, which I really loved. It gave me a chance to build great relationships with the senior leaders in our consulting advisory practice here in the US. At some point, I got a call from our then head of HR saying I was going to get a call from the head of the advisory business asking me to come and be her head of HR for the advisory practice. And he was specific that I actually couldn't say no. That's what he told me. So I used to say that I was asked, I would say I was told, but probably the best voluntold thing that ever happened to me. So because I had a chance to get engaged with her and her leadership team, I had good relationships with them. And my big learning from that moment was that if you have great relationships, even if you don't necessarily have all the skills as you're stepping in to do something different, there's transferability if you can use that in order to move forward. So I understood the business, I understood the people, and I understood the issues that they were navigating. And that allowed me to bring some of the core skills that I had from a recruiting perspective around managing a process, interacting with folks, brokering good outcomes in order to be successful in an HR business partner role. And she went on to become the CEO. And I supported the next head of advisory for a few years before I moved into the next phase of my career.
That's awesome. And you talked about you had that relationship. And so they trusted you to do some more than you were doing today. And I think that's really the formation. When we think about relationships, it's about trust and you have credibility because they're taking a chance on you. And you may have been told to do it, but still is a pretty big jump. What were some of the challenges you faced going into an HR business partner role for the first time? Do you remember what that was like?
Yeah. So there were a handful of them that I remember quite vividly. The first was just experiencing everything for the first time. When I counsel folks about taking on new roles and responsibilities, I try to get them to appreciate that it's going to be a hockey stick about how they feel about it, right? The best they're going to feel about it for probably the first 6 to 12 months is the day they say yes. And it's going to be a bit of a downhill slide as they go through and have to experience everything for the first time. And then they come around on the other side and they feel, okay, now I get it. Now I know how I would apply changes to it. Now I'm the expert. So just going through that cycle for me for the first time was difficult. I think there was a little bit of the business leadership trusted me, but the teams that I came to work with on the HR business partner side didn't really know me very much. I had to spend time recredentializing myself with them, showing them that my knowledge and experience would allow us to collectively be successful, and showing that I trusted them to teach me the pieces of the job that I didn't really understand. Learning how to navigate through that type of relationship was really important. So those were the two big things that I noticed about taking on something totally outside my expertise.
Such great learnings. And I love the hockey stick analogy, because we always feel great. Like, oh, I'm so excited about this role, but you don't really know what you don't know. And then you get in there and you're like, okay, this is harder than I thought. But when you go in knowing that it's going to be challenging, right, to your point, that makes it a little bit easier. Like, hey, this is normal to feel like I'm not great at this role yet, right? I'm working through it. So I think that was brilliant. Really, obviously, it served you well. You've gone on to hold a lot of different roles across KPMG, HR roles. But you also said that being the head of Total Rewards was one of your favorites. Tell us more about what you learned in that role and why it's a soft spot in your heart for it.
Yeah, so this was a yet another circumstance where I sort of stepped in not having all the pieces of the puzzle. So as an HR business partner and the lead for HR for one of our divisions, I understood compensation pretty well, but hadn't been a compensation practitioner. And I had navigated some of the thornier issues related to benefits and transitions and things like that, but again, had never been in charge of any of those plans. Big opportunity for me to build relationships with another part of our organization, to really learn to operate at an enterprise level. And so there were three things about it that really appealed to me. The first was, I'm a big analytics person, so I love the math. I'm happy to dig in and do analysis and try to understand how we're optimizing our spend. You know, Total Rewards, for most organizations, that's going to be their number one or number two expense. And I think as an HR practitioner who's in charge of something like that, you can make an extremely strategic contribution by helping leaders understand the impact of the choices that they're making and making sure that they're getting out of the investment what they're hoping to get out of it. So, and using data to do that is a big thing that I enjoy. Second is, I'm a very big behavioral science lover. And so if I had the opportunity to go back and get an advanced degree, I for sure would do it around behavioral economics or behavioral design. And from my perspective, Total Rewards is 100% about behavioral design. So whether you're talking about compensation or recognition or benefits, all of it is really taking a step back and thinking about what's the outcome that we want from people? What behaviors are we hoping that they'll exhibit as they interact with these tools that are available to companies? And then the last piece is, it allowed me to continue to lean into the brokering part of my job that I really enjoy. So as a recruiter, I grew up enjoying being a broker. And so whether I was brokering between my institution and the vendors who supported us, or between our organization in Total Rewards and the different parts of the HR organization, or between Total Rewards and the institution, there was this opportunity for me to help people make these big, important decisions and be an effective broker. And I really enjoyed that.
It sounds like a great experience, and I totally understand why you'd enjoy it. I think Total Rewards is one of these functions where, as an HR leader, if you want to be a CHRO, you need to get exposure to Total Rewards. You have to. It's like you said, benefits is a really critical cost. There's executive comp. And so my recommendation, I always think, and I'd love to hear your perspective, Jason, is even if you're an HR business partner or an HR VP, you know, or VP of talent, how do you get closer to your Total Rewards leader, understand what they do day to day? I think it's so critical. But what other advice do you have to sort of bridge that aisle and learn more about Total Rewards when you're not sitting in the seat?
First of all, I couldn't agree with your premise more. I think that for someone who wants to continue to progress their career in HR, whether it's spending some time actually in the role or getting close to your Total Rewards folks and really understanding it, it's going to be a big accelerator for you. And there's a couple of additional ways I think you can get after that. One is to take the mindset of, if you're in an HR VP role, you really need to understand the organization's P&L. Total Rewards costs are going to be a huge part of that. And so just thinking about it through that lens and thinking about what are the ways in which you want to influence that, I think can be a big accelerator for you in showing to your business leaders that you're trying to help them achieve their outcomes. Secondly is, again, from a behavioral design perspective, your role as an HR VP is to try to make sure that your leader's agenda gets to the place it wants to get to. And Total Rewards is a huge lever for being able to do that. And so digging in and spending time with your Total Rewards counterparts can really make sure that you get to that place. And then lastly, as a head of HR, you're going to be responsible for trying to make sure there's a great employee experience. And so taking in what that experience of interacting with compensation, with recognition, with benefits, and providing that feedback back to the total rewards leader is a great opportunity to make sure, again, that you're creating and curating a great employee experience in your organization.
Yeah, really great advice around total rewards and helping to get closer to that and really learn that practice. So Jason, I kind of now want to move into some of the, what I think is a little bit of a hot take you have, because you said organizations are actually over-indexing or often over-indexing on talent and capability and not focusing enough on health and wellness of their organizations. Tell us more about why you feel this way.
So the framing that I've been trying to get leaders to appreciate is that a health plus capability equals productivity. And so I've been thinking about it through the sports analogy, right? Lots of large, very successful professional sports teams have figured this out. It's why they have sports psychologists and top end health folks on staff to try to make sure that their players not only have the skills that they need to be able to perform well on the field, but that they can actually stay on the field, that they have the endurance they need to last the entire game, that they can last for an entire season. And so as corporate athletes, I think we need to start thinking about our workforces in a very similar way. How can we make sure that people not only have the skills to do the job, but that they are in the right headspace to be able to do it and that they're physically capable of being able to move it forward? So I know you and I are big fans of Steve Hunt, right? And so Steve has taken this framing around the growth of the changes in the way that work is done from an agricultural environment where people are focused on growing food to a manufacturing environment where they're focused on making things. Now the services environment where they're focused on exceeding expectations, which I think is like a really cool concept. And if you think about it through the lens of if now almost all of the high-end experiences that people are going to have between a customer and their organization is going to involve workers as an intermediary, those people have to be there and they have to be in a great mindset if we want them to be able to exceed expectations. And to do that, it's not just about whether they have the skills to do it. It's about, do they have the will to be able to do it? And are they in the right mindset to be able to do it? I think as organizations, we need to start thinking about how do we curate both sides of that equation? So to be clear, I'm not suggesting we invest less in talent and capability. I just think we need to accelerate our investment in health and maybe not even necessarily spend more money on it. Because as we already talked about, total rewards is already a huge spend inside of organizations. But I think there's a great opportunity for us to think about it more strategically and make sure our leaders are thinking about it strategically, so we're getting the most out of the money that we choose to spend.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really compelling and different way to think this health plus capability equals profitability. I see a book in your future, Jason, on that topic, but it feels very marketable to me. But more, I think what you're talking about is, of course, we still are going to focus on talent capabilities, but how do we do health differently? How do we think a little bit more broader to enable that? And wellness is a big topic. And I know at KPMG, one of your core pillars of your talent strategy is something called Thrive. Tell us more about what Thrive is and how you're bringing health and culture to KPMG.
Yeah, we like to think about health under sort of four big dimensions: physical, mental, financial, and social. And each of these are places where we and every organization can and should make significant investments in order to be able to ensure their workforce is, again, available in the right mindsets and capable of taking advantage of the skills that they have. So from a physical perspective, there's research from the World Economic Forum that shows that there's about $500 billion of productivity loss due to physical health issues on an annual basis. As a reminder, every physical health issue is probably also a mental health issue for the folks who are going through it. So as leaders who are spending a tremendous amount on health insurance and pharmaceutical support, so what people really want is to make sure that what you're giving them works. And so spending time as a leader of Total Rewards who's interacting with these vendors, making sure that people are getting the support that they need for themselves and their families, making sure that you're getting what you're paying for, I think is where our Total Rewards leaders can really lean in and try to maximize the outcome from a physical health perspective. There's a sub-dimension around trying to encourage people to be healthy, which I think continues to be important. But the number one thing is just making sure that it works when it's necessary. From a mental health perspective, again, you're looking at around $200 billion of productivity loss, according to studies from Berkeley. So, and this has a significant impact on absenteeism and presenteeism. And one of the big benefits coming out of the pandemic has been that there's been an increased focus on the importance of mental health, which is outstanding. So I think that there's been a lot of destigmatization and a lot of companies have been focused on this, but there's more that we can do. Inside our organization, we're spending time trying to figure out how can we bring mental health to the masses. How do we get leaders to talk about it in a way that makes it comfortable for others to think about it, something they need to take care of? How do we get leaders on the front lines to be recognizing when somebody might need an intervention and steer them to that intervention? And how can we pilot things like having our employee assistance program actually reach out proactively to people and do a little bit of a health check-in if they're interested, just to figure out where they're at and whether they might need some additional support? Third dimension is financial. So 75% of folks to say that they bring their financial stress to work, according to PNC, and 60% of people are representing they're living paycheck to paycheck. And so as organizations that almost assuredly are making investments in things like 401k contributions and other retirements, and obviously pay is a significant portion of the financial investment, there's a big opportunity to make sure that people feel like you have their back from a financial perspective. And not just with the today issues, right? Do I have enough money to buy groceries? But also the tomorrow issues. So one thing that we chose to do as an example is we moved away from a 401k match and we give everybody a 401k contribution, whether they make their own contribution or not. So because we didn't want them to have to choose between I got to pay down my student loans or I got to buy a new car or want to buy a house and am I saving for my retirement? And again, so I think strategically organizations can think about how are they providing short and long-term financial security to their folks. And then the last dimension around it is really the social component. And there's some sub-elements here that I wanted to just highlight. One of them is friendship. So we just published a study, KPMG, about friends at work, and encourage folks to read that research if they're interested. But 80% of people report that friends at work make them feel more engaged and more productive. So something that organizations probably don't think a lot about is, hey, I'm responsible for the friendships inside my organization. But realistically, it's a big driver for people to join an organization, to stay in an organization, and to give that extra effort. And so thinking about what their role is in curating those professional friendships can be really important. Purpose is another dimension here. Lots of research on the topic about how making sure that people feel like what they do matters and really trying to make sure that organizations are tying between the things they're asking people to do and the way that that's going to make a difference for them and for others. And then lastly, citizenship. So again, there's a good amount of research out there that shows that as people contribute through volunteerism and other forms of citizenship, it not only increases pride in their organization, pride in their work, but also just makes them generally feel better as individuals and want to stick around with an organization. So I think across all four of those dimensions, you can do things to try to make people feel healthier and be healthier, which in the end will hopefully make them more productive.
Yeah, it's a really comprehensive approach. Not that some of this is new, we've had this for a while, but what I love how you're framing this up is that it's really tied back to business. It's tied to how can we help the business grow and also help our employees be more healthy, right? When we talk about whether we're taking 6 days or mental health, and we know that these things actually do impact the bottom line. We just typically haven't made and connected those dots. It's sort of been like a nice to do versus a must do. And it sounds like, you know, at KPMG, you're making this a must do and really thinking about it in a holistic way. You've also talked about benefit costs being a strategic advantage to the organization. We already mentioned this a little bit, which is kind of the opposite, I think, how most HR and business leaders think, because we sort of feel like this is a drag. And we know we live in a very difficult healthcare costs. Sometimes we feel like a victim to that. We're not sure how to lower those healthcare costs, but it's also broader than that. But talk about why you believe this is a strategic advantage and how maybe we should be thinking differently about it.
Yeah. I guess the first thing I would say is if any organization has a cost item on their balance sheet that's $100 million plus, right? So they better be thinking about how they're going to get a strategic advantage out of it. Because if they're not, then they're probably making an investment that they can't really explain very well to their management team or their board. So from my perspective, there's a few different ways in which benefits can be a strategic advantage. We've talked about some of them, but just to kind of reiterate, I think there's an availability issue, right? So if we are using benefits to their greatest effect, our workforce will be more available to help us, which then also creates a productivity. And I would say in productivity, it's not just about how many hours people work, but it's also about, can they bring their best selves? Are they contributing to your culture in positive ways? Are they creative? Are they innovative? It's hard to have vision when you're flinching is a phrase that I've grown to like over the years. And I think for folks, if they're under pressure and dealing with either a physical health issue or a mental health issue, or their family's not feeling as supported as it needs to feel, then you find yourself wandering down this path of not being able to be as big of a contributor as you otherwise would. I also think there's a big element of risk avoidance here. So from a few different dimensions, right? So I think when people are not in the best mindsets, they tend to make more mistakes. They tend to make choices that we wouldn't be as excited for them to make. As an organization, the more we rely on reactive support instead of proactive support, we're actually making it more expensive and more risky to take care of the folks who are part of our organization. And so at the end of the day, it boils down to you want to have a brand that people want to come to work for. So if you're, there's great ways for you to be able to invest in your benefits, make sure they're clear and present to the people you're recruiting. You want people, when they get to you, to be available and productive. You also want to be there for them in those moments that matter to them. And when you are, that creates a stickiness, right? When people know that you have their back and it's up against the wall, that's a big moment for them. And then lastly, at least for our organization, but probably for a lot, not everybody's going to be an employee for a lifetime, but they can potentially be a customer, or they can talk about you to others who might work for you. And you want them to speak well of you when they leave your organization. And if you take care of them in those moments that matter, they're far more likely to do that. So I think as leaders, we should be thinking about these big costs and how we're going to get strategic advantage out of them. And benefits for me is a pretty easy one.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's a great reframe. It's also an opportunity where I think some organizations have done this, where you really strategically say, we're going to overinvest in benefits as a reason why people stay with us, right? Because when you start to maybe get that phone call from another company, and then you go, well, actually, my benefits are paid for fully, or, you know, I have a really low deductible, or whatever that happens to be, or I feel really taken care of in a holistic framework from financial, mental health, et cetera. Yeah, maybe you think that's not why someone would stay, but I think some people do think twice about that. And I love what you guys are doing on the 401k and the automatic match. I think those things are, people know you're taking care of them. So it goes a long ways in building goodwill. So I think that's terrific. But, you know, Jason, you guys have been on this journey for a while. What would you say to HR leaders who are wanting to champion health and capability equally in their organizations? And where would they take that first step to get health plus capability equals profitability equation?
So I think that they would start exactly where you suggested, which is kind of reframing it as something that is going to contribute to the business, not just to the employee experience. It should do everything that we do in HR should largely be able to be framed to do both. And I think from a total rewards perspective, particularly a health perspective, we focused almost exclusively on it as a retention tool, which it is. But I think that beginning to be able to talk about both dimensions and some of the things that you and I have covered today, I think reframing for yourself what that looks like, going through the choices that you've made, really can help you do that. Second thing I think you can do is to take a look at your data, right? So we talked about my love of Pat, but being able to lean in and see, what does the story tell you today? How healthy is your workforce today? What are people telling you about the experience? What are you seeing in your insurance book of business? So how are people using your services? Is it consistent with what you want them to do? Not just looking at it as an entitlement that's just there and people are going to use it however they want to, but really being strategic about trying to shape the behavior around it, which kind of brings me to that last point of, if this is largely about how can we shape behavior, then you have to be proactive. You have to have a plan for where you want people to go, and then lay that out for yourself, for your team, for your leaders, and ultimately for the people in your organization, and then use the tools that are available to you to help shape people to make the decisions that you know are going to be good for them and you know are going to be good for your organization. So that's where I would encourage leaders to start.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I love that part about being proactive. I think that's something you need to go initiate and not wait for your benefits broker to come tell you what to do. Be thoughtful about that and take the action on your own. Another part of your talent strategy is grow capabilities and work smart. And you're doing some really innovative work around work and skills transformation. Can you talk to us about how you're putting skills at the center of your talent decisions?
I'm super excited about this piece of it. So again, if our intent is to try to get to this equation of health plus capability equals profitability, then we have to pay attention to the capability side of it as well. And the skills transformation, especially in a knowledge organization like ours, is a big opportunity for us. So skills we're looking at as being that golden thread that runs across all of our talent processes. I think the first thing for people to appreciate is that it's a bit of a change from the way we think about jobs themselves, right? So historically, we've sort of thought about jobs as, you know, call them chess pieces, right? There's lots of different ways in which a chess game can play out. But at the end of the day, chess pieces are limited to the movement types that they have at the beginning of the game. That never changes. And that's a little bit about the way that jobs have been constructed historically. Now we're trying to get people to think about jobs or roles inside of an organization more like Legos. So now we have folks who have a set of skills. And those skills one day might be used to build a house, the next day to be used to build flowers, the next day to be used something from Harry Potter. It's the different ways in which Legos can be deployed in order to be able to sort of drive a different way of thinking about how work gets constructed. So I think when you move away from job responsibilities and people attaching to those jobs, and instead think about them as individuals and the unique skills and capabilities that they have, it really opens up an ability for you to move talent around an organization in a way that you probably haven't thought about previously. So then you get to the questions of, okay, how do you actually do that? And so in our organization, we've spent time thinking about how can you attach skills to the individual? So we've been investing in the technology and the data infrastructure that's going to allow us to be able to look at the tens of thousands of folks who work for us and understand what are their core skills today and where do we want to try to take those going forward. And then we're looking at each of the different elements of our talent processes and thinking about how we can work skills into that environment. From a learning perspective, how do we make sure that our individuals have learning plans that are associated with advancing the skills they have and adding the skills that they need? From a recruiting perspective, how can we transition from being more job-centric to more skill-centric, featuring skills in both the job postings that we have, but also in the interview process? From a total rewards perspective, how do we lean more into skills from a pay perspective? And so on down the line, you can go through each of the areas of HR and say, this is highly applicable to the way that we think about how talent flows through our organization. We've thought about this concept of a talent supply chain and it really being interconnected back to from a demand perspective and how that all ties into workforce planning and being able to get to a place where you move again from sort of this focus on very static jobs to individuals who are highly talented and have these dynamic skill sets that are going to change over time. I think it's a big unlock for organizations, not just for the institution, which I think is really great, but also for the individual. Because we hear, especially from our early career hires, that what they're looking for is the opportunity to build their careers, do different things, and have interesting career paths. And the easiest way for them to be able to do that is to have a skills-centric focus so that they can be picking up skills in different engagements that then naturally allow them to move around like a jungle gym inside our organization.
I love it. Good analogies inside here. So we got Legos, or just to Legos. And you may have young kids who are talking about Harry Potter. That's my guess. And then third, now we're talking about the jungle gym, and I love it. It's interesting because, you know, this focus on skills and careers and career development, I'm a big fan of, and I think there's a lot of reason to get very focused on skills and tying that back to a career development or a talent marketplace and your learning development and personalized learning development. Where I think it is more challenging for some organizations, but maybe less challenging for KPMG, is really starting to do the taxonomy of skills across a lot of roles. You have to be very targeted. It's maybe different, tell me if I'm wrong, in consulting where you are project-based and it really is skill-based, because as a client comes to you with a need, it's pretty easy to understand or quickly say, what skills do we have to make sure this is capable, whether that's data analytics, strategy, and then hopefully pull from that pool of people that you have to go on that project. And I know more organizations are doing project-based work, but how do you see that, Jason, from KPMG to, hey, I'm a Fortune 500 that manufactures something? How do you see the differences or how you think about it?
Yeah. So I was at the Gartner conference this fall and had the opportunity to sit in on a panel that was done. And the people who were on the panel were actually from oil and gas organizations. They were talking about their skills transformation journey and a lot of similarities between it, right? So being able to think about that there are likely a core set of capabilities that people have that are transferable across large portions of the organization. So for sure, there are going to be some places in your organization where you need deep specialists. And yes, you want them to add skills, but you're probably not going to see them move around the organization quite as much, either because they don't want to. Like some folks just love what they do and that's what they want to do for their career, or because you need them to be there, they're willing to be there, and that's the focus. But, you know, if you think about the G&A functions in any large organization between HR, finance, IT, marketing, many of the core craft skills that are necessary in a lot of the jobs are transferable when you think about them at the skills level. So we have folks certainly who have been part of our total rewards organization that have come from the finance group as an example, right? And we've seen folks move between analytics organizations across that. And the whole concept of shared services is basically built on this principle that there's a transferability of basic skills and even advanced skills across different areas of an organization. I do think that even at the specialized point, right? So imagine you're a pharmaceutical company or an energy company. There's likely subdimensions of what you're doing across even the front and middle office. And so while it might be not transferable to take your pharmaceutical expertise and bring it into an oil and gas company, it's highly probable that there's different places across your pharmaceutical organization that you can move scientists and product specialists and so on. And today we tend to think about, hey, I'm in a division. I work for a set of people. They're going to take care of my career and help me move forward. When you deconstruct that back to the skills context, it allows people to think about, you know what, maybe I'm in department A, but I actually could make a big contribution over in department B. The last point that I want to make is when we think about things in the jobs context, we tend to think about work being done in small static teams and work sort of flows through them on a regular basis. When you think about it in the skills context, it's much easier for us to say, we're either going to do this thing that nobody's ever done before, and we're going to go get a set of people from a bunch of different places and have confidence that they're going to be able to contribute, Or it allows us to say, hey, we're trying to do something over here in this department that has, and we don't necessarily have the resources that we need. So before we rush to the outside to bring in somebody who maybe doesn't understand our culture, hasn't had experience working with us before, we can perhaps go over here and find somebody who's got 75% of the skills we're looking for and ramp them up into the organization. So I totally agree with your point that inside of a professional services organization, this is a supernatural thing for us to do. But I've spent time thinking about that it works pretty effectively, irrespective of the industry that you're in. And the proof for me was hearing some folks at the Gartner conference from some of these other industries talk about how it's transformed their organizations as well.
Yeah, that's really helpful to hear that. And I do think a big unlock is just the mindset for a team member or for your own individual career to think in skills. Because like, what skills am I building? How am I getting better? How am I staying agile? Because the world's moving so fast. So I think that part is really, really key. And then I love the idea of you don't have to have 100% of the skills. We need 70%. Is that transferable? I mean, can't people learn? I think we sometimes get so pigeonholed in the past experience that we actually overlook great talent. And we need to take more chances on talent that have those knowledge of the company and have some good core skills that we think can transfer.
Yeah. So just one quick point I wanted to add on that, because I couldn't agree with you more, is it's not just about people making the decision around who's going to be on the team and convincing them to accept 75% of the skills. More than half of it, I find on a regular basis, is actually convincing individuals that they should take that chance on themselves, right? And lean in. And that's been a hallmark of my career, as we talked about as we've gone through this conversation. But I think that's as big of, if not bigger, a barrier is, I think folks generally, when they think about how they're going to move around, even with inside their organization, they're largely saying, well, I don't have 100% of that, so I'm just going to just pass on the opportunity. That's the mindset that we've got to change as much as we do leaders who are making talent decisions.
Yeah, thank you for underlining that. I think it's easy to say, hard to do, but whether we think we can or we think we can't, we're right. There's many times on the podcast I've heard similar stories to you where you're sort of voluntold or dragged into a role that you were like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that role. I'm not sure. I'm not ready. And someone else thought you were ready. I've said this many times, but I really think if you have that experience and you're early in your career and someone says to you, I want you to take this role, even if you think you're not ready, go, right? Because you'll be ready. You'll figure it out. And that's what life's all about. The last part I wanted to talk to you about, another part of the talent strategy I think is really interesting, is called Work Smart. Tell us more about this and how it's helping you guys make better talent decisions at KPMG.
A couple of big dimensions around Work Smart that I wanted to highlight. One I already talked about, which is the talent supply chain. And I think the big unlock for us was really realizing that you can't make any decisions along that supply chain that don't fundamentally impact another one. So if you're making a change to the way that you're going to do recruiting, it's going to naturally have an impact on the way that you have to think about learning and talent deployment. Historically, these departments have maybe reported to the same leader, and that person effectively became responsible for trying to see across it. But realistically, a lot of them reported to different leaders, and there was just a very disaggregated view of how things were being done and how that whole system needed to evolve together. So we've taken a step back and said, we're going to think more horizontally, less vertically about it. And we're going to try to make sure that the projects that we're doing across the talent supply chain, the skills investment to make sure we have a consistent golden thread and taxonomy across the supply chain, and interacting very carefully and closely with the demand side of the business, right? Understanding what our sales pipeline looks like, understand what our delivery model looks like. Those things are going to be really important for how we think about talent on a go-forward basis. The other big investment that we're making is around delivery model transformation. And so from an HR perspective, it's us trying to understand what are the impacts of AI, the impacts of different ways and places in which work can be done, how our ecosystem is evolving, working with first and third parties in order to be able to deliver client work, and having that all be collectively part of our delivery model thinking and then flowing into our talent supply chain. And so we've invested a lot in working closely with our business leaders, with our head of digital and AI, and with other people who are driving that transformation. Because the reality is our industry and every industry is undergoing a significant amount of transformation. There's no way that our organization won't be substantially different 5 and 10 years from now. And so we don't know the answers for everything that that's going to look like, but we have begun to understand what some of the building blocks are. And we're starting to say, how do we prepare people for that change? How do we get them ready, practicing and using the skills that we have today? And how do we make thoughtful projections around where it's like to go and then likely to go, and then making some strategic bets that we hope can allow us to get there as efficiently and effectively as possible. So this delivery model transformation is a big other component around our Work Smart initiatives. And together, those two things hopefully are really allowing us to maximize our investment in the talent that we have in our organization.
Jason, last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so I'm a big Ted Lasso fan. So I decided to go with a phrase from my favorite scene, which is I'm encouraging everyone to be curious and not judgmental. So if you've seen the show, you know that my absolute favorite scene is when Ted is playing darts with another player and he goes through this whole soliloquy about how people sort of underestimated him because they didn't basically take time to really understand the situation before making a judgment. And again, I mentioned that I went to the Gartner conference and there were a couple of things there that really struck me as being interrelated to this. The first was Peter Hinson used this term called never normal. And I totally agree. That's basically the environment that we find ourselves in. The pace of change is going to continue to accelerate. So it's faster now than it's ever been, and it's only going to get faster from here. And as HR professionals, we're going to be asked on the regular to give quick answers to things and make snap decisions. And I think if we fall prey to that, we run the risk of putting ourselves in harm's way, putting our companies in harm's way, putting our people in harm's way. So taking that time to really be curious and ask questions and make sure you understand the context of the situation, I think is going to go a long way towards making our listeners hopefully be really successful in their HR careers. I also think that people should be curious about the ways in which things are actually changing. Every day, there's a new article about a new technology that potentially has some applicability inside of our industry. You're not going to buy them all. You're probably never going to use them all, but it's not that hard to stay up on what's happening. And that's one of the things that I really love to do is I like to look at how things like AI and automation and other tools are being used in other industries that have some similarities like sales and finance and IT, and think about how could we use that inside of our own profession. So really trying to be curious from that perspective. And then the last point on this dimension is Amy Edmondson was also at the Gartner conference and talked about this concept of productive failure. And basically she laid out a construct, which I loved and I would highly recommend reading her book, that it encourages people to set up a situation in which they're doing something that it's okay to not have it go right. And she sort of laid out, these are the rules against which if you have them in place, then it's okay to find failure. I think a lot of our organizations, a lot of our people in organizations tend to think that they can't fail under any circumstances. And as a result, they tend to be pretty conservative in the choices that they make and they don't try things out that would have been allowed them to move much faster. Bringing that curiosity in a way that's managed so that you're not driving yourself into big failures and you're setting yourself up for potential successes, I think can allow our folks to be curious and hopefully lean in and do some things they wouldn't have otherwise thought of. So that's my advice to the group is to be curious and not too quick to be judgmental.
I'm a big Ted Lasso fan myself, so be curious, not judgmental. Jason, we're definitely curious about your career. We're curious about more about KPMG. You guys are doing great work. So appreciate you coming on the podcast. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I loved it. So look forward to connecting again soon.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Jason for sharing his thoughts on how health and capability can drive productivity and so much more. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Every Thursday, I'll drop in your inbox with one big idea that'll get you thinking, two questions to challenge your perspective, and three actions you can take to level up your HR leadership game. Think of it as your weekly HR leadership booster shot. Quick, powerful, and designed to help you put ideas into practice immediately. So go to futureofhr.com and subscribe. And be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders. And it's simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with Anna Tavis, who's a researcher, educator, and author. Anna is the department chair of human capital management at the New York University, and she's a sought-after speaker, and her writings appeared in publications like Harvard Business Review. She's joining us to talk about her latest book, Digital Coaching Revolution, and share how AI will impact learning, development, and coaching. This is a great conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.